Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 19 of NML Crossing, where we are in the second leg, or second era, or second phase of the show. We're out of the cataclysm, and we are into the aftershock. And we're going to be kicking it off with an issue of Shadow of the Bat. It's a milestone, landmark, 75th issue, which is kind of baffling to me. Like, honestly, had you told me that Shadow of the Bat reached issue 25, I'd have probably cocked an eyebrow and been like, really? Did it? Huh? To know that it made it almost 100 issues is pretty insane. And that's not an indictment on the quality of the book, mind you. It's just something that I, for whatever reason, kind of, I guess, compartmentalize with my early 90s comics fandom, and it's hard to kind of see it out of that context, see it in more, relatively speaking, modern times, you know, the turn of the century and whatnot. But without spiraling further into the sort of surreal presence that is Shadow of the Bat in the late 90s, how about we get into it? Because we've got two stories to discuss today. This is a, I don't know if we'd call it a double-sized. It's definitely extra-sized. It's a dollar more expensive than usual, and we do have a backup story, which does contextualize the lead story, and it's a quirky, offbeat sort of thing. Definitely in Alan Grant's wheelhouse, and definitely going to be a lot of fun. So, or fun might not be the right word for it, considering the subject matter. It'll be good. That's what I'll say. Let's get into it. Batman, Shadow of the Bat number 75, had a June 1998 cover date. Story's called Aftershock 1, by fire, ...... by ice. Script by Alan Grant, and it's something about Alan Grant. We're going to talk a bit more about him in general toward the end of the show, but he's the only one that I've noticed so far that will change the credit from writer to script. Now, I don't know if that's something he requests on certain books, maybe ones that he doesn't write the story for, but just scripts what editorial tells him to script. I don't know. I mean, we've seen folks like Steve Englehart, who will give his John Harkness, you know, nom de plume if he disagrees with a script or with an editorial direction or whatever. I don't know if Alan Grant has it where if it's not 100% his story, it's just script. I mean, he's going to bounce back and forth throughout this thing, so we won't worry about it too much. Pencils by our friend Mark Buckingham, Bucky. Inks, Wayne Foucher. Colors, Pam Rambo and Android Images. Letters, Bill Oakley. Edit, Scorpion Gill O'Neill. Cover price, $2.95. Now, our story opens atop Breyfogle International, which is apparently located on Artist's Alley, as pretty much every single building and storefront is named after a different Batman or DC Comics proper artist. I guess it probably stands to reason this is a 75th issue. Maybe they're, you know, paying tribute to some of the folks who took a part in the first 74 issues of Shadow of the Bat. Anyway, it's here where we get kind of a reverse Superman 701. You know, the first chapter of Grounded, the worst Superman story ever written, still, where in that story, Superman pretty much tells a suicidal woman to go ahead and jump to her death if she really wants to. Awful, awful story. Here, we've got a fellow who's lost everything in the very bad thing that happened, and, well, he is looking to end it all. Batman, of all people, is there to try to talk him off the ledge. He attempts to sympathize with the man. Of course, Batman himself is no stranger to loss. The man wavers, but still appears to be steadfast in his decision to jump. In the background, we can see a Jurgens and Company sign, so Dan Jurgens gets a little nod here. Now, Batman realizes he can't be spending his entire night talking this fella down, and so he uses his bat rope to tie him up till he can come back, so he can't go nowhere. From here, our hero takes to the streets where he dodges almost poetic descriptions of how various Gothamites perished in the quake. We get a death count of 10,000, which sounds really low, especially when the Robin issue we just discussed last episode said it was over 100,000. He passes by the Bright Gallery and the Giorano Bistro, you know, M.D. Bright and Vince Giorano. There's an issue of the Gotham Globe going by in the foreground that says Kitson is headed for the World Series. And I mean, I'm all for this kind of fun stuff, but I mean, we're like two pages in and we already have five name drops. I don't know. You know, we talk about things that take us out of the story, and it's like, we've got a man threatening to jump. We've got a city in ruins, and I'm pointing out artists' names that are hidden in the pencils here. Anyway, let's turn the page, and hey, two more name drops. We got Batman watching on as a crew from Burchett Construction clears up some debris outside the Staten and Leon Bank. Then, our main man spies something quite unexpected. It's a police officer cocooned in a crude block of ice. From here, we shift scenes to miles and miles below the surface, where we meet up with the ultimate Clayface. Now, he wound up down here following the events of the Mud Pack four-parter that occurred in Detective Comics 604 through 607. That was July through October of 1989. And that's a story that I actually covered in full at the blog back in June of 2016 that I could not remember in the slightest. Anyway, that story ended with Basil Carlo being overloaded with power by Looker from the Outsiders and then being sent out a window and falling to and through the Earth. And that's a story that was written by our man Alan Grant. Now, I guess we're about to add Clayface to our No Man's Land chessboard, but and I tell you what, I never realized at this point that he'd already been off like the all-around Batman chessboard for like just about a decade, right? That's a long time to keep a villain down. Anyway, he's trapped in the down below until the quake, which opens a fissure through which he can escape up to the surface. Back to Batman. Now, we learn that Victor Freeze was in transit from one prison to another when the quake hit. His transport was smashed up by some falling debris, and he escaped, immediately running off to swipe some diamonds in order to power his cryo suit blaster gimmick. And it's kind of cute. He's literally holding a giant bag with the word diamonds on it. It's like, you know, like the money sign bag like that robbers would have in cartoons. It literally says diamonds. And he stole them from Dudkowitz Diamonds, by the way, so another name drop there. Anyway, he finds himself held up by a pair of Gotham's finest, who he freezes up with his cryo whatsits. He also gives us some pretty cheesy lines while he's at it. I don't know enough about Mr. Freeze to know if he was always really, really punny, or if this is a result of the Schwarzeneggerization of Mr. Freeze from whichever Batman movie that was. Like, when they tell him to freeze, he says, "Freeze is the operative word." And then for literally no reason, he says, "Cold hands, warm heart." He just says it. It's like a total non sequitur. I don't know. Anyway, back to Batman, who uses his, would we say infrared goggles? I don't know. He uses whatever goggles in order to find and follow the chilly trail of Mr. Freeze. In so doing, he passes by Aparo Originals and the Collins Street subway station. So a couple more name drops. Now back to Basil, who claws his way out of the ground, scaring the bejesus out of a pair of Good Samaritans who were there trying to help pull him out. Clayface reveals that he now has fire-ish powers, which he exhibits by, you know, tossing like electrified flame all over the place. The Gothamites scatter, crying out for Batman to help them. Our baddie pulls one of them aside and asks where Batman was last seen, because he'd really, really like to pay him a surprise visit. The dude says he thinks the Bat is on Collins Street. And, you know, to thank him for the information, Clayface kills the poor fellow with fire. Back to Batman, he's still following the frosty footprints of the other Big Bad, and he manages to find him with relative ease. He's hiding out in the staff room of a nearby movie theater. Freeze welcomes the interloper to his ice palace and says he's now set for life insofar as having, like, almost too many diamonds to power his cryo whatsits. He then blasts our hero with a phosphor flare. Batman dodges the shot and knocks Freeze right the F out with one punch to the mush. So, I guess, der her, just one punch? Yeah, okay. Batman drags the KO'd Freeze out of the place and uses an explosive charge to cave in the entrance, thus entombing the big ol' sacks of diamonds until the GCPD can, you know, come on over and attend to them. Our hero is then blasted in the back by a wad of Kirby Crackle, and again, it is the ultimate Clayface. He doesn't even have to introduce himself because Batman appears to be handling MC duties here. He's hit by from behind, he looks and he goes, "Basil Carlo, the actor who became the ultimate Clayface." I don't know. Anyway, our next bit has Basil revealing what he's been up to since 1989. Of course, we know he plummeted through the earth, but he wound up landing in a deep quartz cavern. He wound up absorbing the power of quartz into his being, giving him piezoelectric powers, which is actually a thing. It was discovered by a pair of French physicists back in 1880, the Curie brothers, Jacques and Pierre, and Pierre was married to Marie Curie. Now, it's basically electricity resulting from pressure and heat. Crystals, including quartz, were used. Now, quartz, along with Rochelle salt, were actually the best conductors. Studies show that a cubic centimeter of quartz with 2 kilonewton or 500 pounds of applied force can produce 12,500 volts. Quartz would actually go on to be the first commercially exploited piezoelectric material. So, the more you know. Anyway, yada yada yada, he's underground, the quake happens, Clayface gets out, and here we are. And we are rolling around on the decimated streets of Gotham City. And we roll right past the sign for TaylorMade. Another name drop. Oddly, Batman engages in a bit of banter here. That doesn't feel right, but we'll let it be. Anyway, Batman remembers that Mr. Freeze's gun is somewhere nearby, and he attempts to make a grab for it. Carlo has other plans, however, hurling our hero into the ruins of the Walker Bar and Grill, or maybe into an open pit. It's not immediately clear where he winds up. Basil starts pumping the pit full of the PZO Whatsits. Batman then calls out to Mr. Freeze, and he taunts him. He's like, "Hey, looks like Clayface is going to be the one to finally kill me, unless you do something." And, well, Mr. Freeze, he decides to do something. He ain't about to let Clayface take that victory, and so we are thrust into some baddie-on-baddie action. Though not before Freeze says that this turn of events is rather uncool. Ugh. Now, from here, we get around a half dozen pages of a fire and ice fight. Clayface manages to get a good shot in on Freeze, which ruptures his cryo suit. Batman then bat ropes the Aparo original sign and yoinks it down to KO Clayface, which was a little bit anticlimactic, wasn't it? Now, our guide then uses Freeze's own cryo gun against him before alerting Star Labs and the GCPD to come pick the baddies up. We close out back at the Breyfogle Institute, where it would appear that our would-be jumper has had himself a change of heart. He wants to live. But he also has a question for the Batman. And that question is, why? I wonder if he was there for Riddler's Tale of Madness the other day. No. Actually, the why here is for, why does Batman still do what he does? You know, why did Batman ever do what he did? But especially now, I mean, everything's gone. There's no hope. So why does Batman keep fighting? And Batman replies, giving a speech that, I guess J. Michael Straczynski did not read before crapping out Grounded. It's basically it's like a boilerplate. Life goes on because it has to. With an added bit of, you know, you're grieving. And that's okay. Let it out. And we get a final, you know, death is a reminder of how precious life is, sort of a, you know, topper. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. And that's the end of our story, but I got a question for y'all. Do you want to know a little bit more about our would-be jumper? You're probably thinking, no, why do we need to know anything more about this guy? Well, we're going to do this anyway. Our second story is called A Long, Slow Death. Script by Alan Grant. Pencils, Norm Breyfogle. Inks, Mark Buckingham. Colors, Pam Rambo. Letters, Bill Oakley. Edits, Gorfinkel O'Neill. And our story opens 3 months ago with our jumper, a fella named Walter. He's playing with his son, Keith. And it's innocent stuff, you know. He tosses the young lad up in the air and he catches him. You know, the stuff that you see dads do all the time. You've seen it a million times. Unfortunately, well, this dad's got a case of the Butterfingers here. He cannot catch the boy, and Keith winds up hitting the ground head and neck first and is rendered paralyzed. So some real light and fluffy reading we're doing today, huh? Anyway, we jump ahead to a month later, and Keith is still in the hospital. A doctor tells the family that Keith's spinal column is damaged beyond repair. He'll never walk, run, or even speak again. Walter obviously blames himself. Walter's parents are there to try and assure him that accidents happen, but our guy still can't help but to blame himself. He asks if his wife Karen can ever forgive him, to which she says, maybe you should ask Keith that question. Which, yeesh, I mean, I get it, but that's kind of cold, isn't it? Walter, on the way out of the hospital, goes to pick up his daughter Sonia, but Karen freaks the F out and stops him, picks the girl up herself and leaves, so she doesn't want a repeat of what happened to Keith to happen to their daughter. We jump ahead another month later, and we're with Walter at work. He works at a delicatessen, and it's apparently the only business in Gotham City not named after an artist or a writer. There, he's comforted by a female worker named Julie. She insists upon him that he needs to stop brooding and just do whatever he can to be there for his son, because Keith needs him now more than ever. We follow our man home, where he attempts to get Keith to say his own name. This does not work. Walter apologizes to his son. We jump ahead to yesterday, where the deli is being visited by some mob thugs who are offering to sell Walter some protection services. He refuses to pay, and so the place gets a bit busted up, and so does his face. Once the goon squad clears out, Julie appears. She's there to tend to Walter's broken face, and, you know, their eyes meet, their lips come closer together, and they wind up making out. We follow Walter home again, and Karen is shocked to see the sort of state he's in. He's beaten, he's bruised, he's even more slump-shouldered than usual. He lies and tells her that he was mugged. Maybe it's not a complete lie, he was sort of, I don't know. Anyway, she helps him get comfortable and says that she's going to call a doctor. She picks up his jacket and sees a suspicious handkerchief sticking out of the pocket. It's got some red on it. It's got some lipstick on it. So, rut-row. Now, our man, he insists that it's blood. But Karen ain't no dummy. Blood and lipstick are two very different substances, right? Before a big ol' argument can commence, Sonia runs in the room to announce that there's some sort of beautiful light show happening outside. And maybe these were those sparks that Batman said that he saw before the quake happened? I don't know. It looks like a sort of sparkly aurora borealis, which you'd think the Gothamites might be more scared of than in awe of. Because, like, really, what in the hell's going on here? And, I mean, this is a town full of psychotic supervillains, so it's like you see these, you know, psychedelic sights in the sky, you'd probably assume that you're about to be offed. Anyway, the light show, it turns out, is just so damned spectacular that it causes Keith to utter his first word in months. Now, he says that the lights are pretty. We jump ahead to the next day, and, well, it's right around 7 p.m. Walter has some words to say before a big family dinner. He fesses up to his makeout session, and the fact that he just got beat up by some gangsters. He says he'll be contacting the police about that tomorrow. He and Karen kiss, and it looks like everything is finally coming up Walter. We follow our man into the kitchen, and the clock strikes 7:03. The house, with the exception of the kitchen, it seems, collapses into a quake fissure. And Walter is the last man standing. He's the only survivor. That's where we leave it. Next time out, more aftershocks in Batman 555. Now, before we get into thoughts on the issue, I did want to at least comment on the letters pages. Now, the letters pages are going to become more of a fixture in this program as we, you know, get a little bit deeper in and we get people writing in about relevant issues, right? But there's something about the Shadow of the Bat letters pages that, I don't know, it stands out to me. It feels very, I'm not sure the right word for it. Like a lot of times you'll see a letters page and it's just people griping or it's people just blowing sunshine just so they get their letters printed. Here, these are all like almost like personal missives to Alan Grant. And Alan Grant's an interesting dude. This reminds me of like a lot of the old Morrison work, like Morrison's Doom Patrol and Invisibles. Those letters pages were sometimes, well, in the case of Invisibles, Invisibles was a series that I tried so many times, and could never really got it, I guess. But I loved collecting the single issues because of the letters pages and just how, I don't know, how weird they were. I mean, I don't want to get crude, but I mean, there was stuff in the Invisibles letters pages about sigils and, well, manual self-gratification that, it was like a magic spell they were trying to cast in order to improve sales on the book. It was very, very bizarre, very interesting, and a real time capsule of, you know, what letters pages could be and what they used to be in some situations. And Doom Patrol was similar. Not quite to that extreme, but I don't know, they felt personal. They felt like a reading club, like a book club. Now here with Shadow of the Bat, I'm seeing something that I don't think I've ever seen before in a letters page. And I don't consider myself a political person. I'm not qualified to talk politics. I find that politics is a great way to lose friends and alienate people, right? It's very seldom a way of bringing people together. You know, it's one of those things that reminds us of the very few things between us that are different instead of all the massive amount of things that we have in common. And can be like that real bone of contention and can cost you friendships and family members and all sorts of crap. It's not worth the time. Especially in the past decade or so, it's been real ugly. But all that to say, these letters pages here, I've never seen a writer in the same letters page being called out for being too liberal, and then in the next letter being called out for being too conservative. And Grant, to his credit, takes it in stride here, and he almost plays with it. Even mentioning, you know, his liberal friends think he's too conservative and his conservative friends think he's too liberal. I think he's like a lot of us, you know, our beliefs and outlooks don't line up 100% with anything because they shouldn't. But it's just so interesting here to see these very, very passionate fans. And I mean, I'm looking at this through a 2024 lens here. So these folks, maybe back in 1998, they seemed like they were being jerks, or they were trying to incite a fight. But through the prism of what we have now, with online discourse and just, you say one thing I disagree with and you're dead to me, these are downright respectful. And it's just such a reminder of what comics fandom could be. Not just sharing ideas about the stories we read, but about what those stories might mirror in the real world, and a lot of projection as to what a writer means by something, by including something or excluding something or framing something a certain way. Alan Grant is a writer who knows subtlety. I think that's something that's missing in a lot of our current year writers. Grant writes in a way that's so subtle that you can try to mold his views into whatever prism you want, you know, and like I said, Grant takes it in stride here and seems to be almost amused by it. And it's just so interesting to see. It really makes me miss the days where, you know, people could amicably disagree. Like I said, I'm not a political person. I never, ever engage in any kind of political discussion because I live in a fantasy world. I mean, I'm surrounded by comic books and action figures. You know, I'm definitely not versed well enough in the real world to opine on it, and nor do I want to be. I don't think that would bring me any joy or pleasure or would enrich my life in any way, but I don't know. If you have these Shadow of the Bat issues, or any Shadow of the Bat issues, I'd wager, maybe take a look at the letters page, just to check them out. You know, you might, you know, find some fun conversation, something to make you think, maybe make you nostalgic for the pre-internet days. I mean, it's all apropos of nothing. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. It was just something that I saw and wanted to comment on. And it's one of the reasons why the original single issues, we do not call them floppies here, but the original single issues are always going to be my preferred comic book story delivery system, I guess. But with that out of the way, let's hop into some thoughts about this issue. And this was one of those stories that I really enjoyed. I like them both, but don't have a whole lot to say about either. we can talk about our superhero punchy stuff here. I'm usually not big on characters like Mr. Freeze or Clayface, but I thought they were well used here. I dug them here. Of course, bad Schwarzenegger-esque cold puns and one-liners aside, because those were pretty bad. Now, something I really... I'm discovering that I enjoy about Alan Grant's work here, and I said we were going to be talking about Grant a lot this episode. I really, really like how loyal he is to his own stories and his seeming willingness to let ideas and characters kind of dangle and kind of bubble away for, well, in this case, like forever before reintroducing or readdressing them. You know, it's, I guess we could say it's Claremontian, right? And it's such, I mean, it's such a wonderful reminder of the way comics used to be. I mean, we read in that Wizard special a few episodes ago that he was thinking about bringing back Joe Friggin' Potato at some point during No Man's Land. And Joe Potato is a character who I would bet that even the most seasoned and knowledgeable Bat fans would have to look up, because who the hell is Joe Potato? And here in this issue, he's bringing back the ultimate Clayface, who hadn't been seen since that Mudpack story arc a decade before. Nowadays, entire comics universes and continuities can't keep their stuff together for even half that long. And here we have Alan Grant just jumping back into his own, you know, his own story pool and bringing it forward and reintroducing characters in a way that's logical and in a way that is organic. I don't know, I thought that was really, really cool. And I mean, nowadays, I hate saying nowadays, because it always has that negative connotation, but characters die and they're back a month later, right? Like, they, like, physically, literally die, dead bodies on the ground, and they're back weeks later, maybe a month later. Here we got a character, Clayface, he's a member of the Rogues Gallery, right? The Batman Rogues Gallery, and he was gone off the board for a decade. We would never see that now. We would just never see that now. Because, I don't know, editorial teams don't talk. And we can kill Clayface in an issue of Batman, and then 3 weeks later he's in an issue of Flash. You know, it's a whole new world, right? Like, we can't point a finger and say what the editors do while they're on the clock, but we damn sure know what they had for lunch every day, don't we? Anyway, enough of that. I apologize. I'm trying not to... spiral, but happens to the best of us, and it even happens to me. Let's dial this one back in here. I suppose we could talk a little bit about that jumper, right? This is the sort of, I guess, plot device that normally comes across as being rather cheap, at least to me. I feel like it could be seen as easy and low effort, like pathos bait, you know, kind of like we saw in that painfully horrid first chapter of Superman Grounded. Though, in fairness to JMS, that awfully, awfully written scene in particular does have some resonant dialogue in it to me personally at this point. Here, though, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Maybe makes sense is the wrong way of saying it. Maybe it would be better to say it's more understandable. I mean, even without reading the backup story, all we need to know in the moment is that this is a man who lost everything in a moment, right? With the quakey context, we're equipped to put two and two together, and I mean, it just evokes empathy. We can empathize with him and for him. It's a hopeless situation. Everything in his life is out of control. well, almost everything. Now, with the eventual added context of Walter's life and times over the past few months, that hopelessness is amplified. Here we see a man he's lost it all, was finally working his way back to, I don't know, not even like normalcy, but maybe peace. And just when there was a little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, well, the clock struck 7:03. I mean, the jumper, it's a gimmick, and it's emotional bait, but it works. It also facilitates Batman's speech about the value of life, which, like, paints him as this strange little flicker of hope in the post-quake wasteland that is, or I suppose was, Gotham City. Seeing Batman show this human side and seemingly caring so much about the decision that this one fella is thinking of making, I don't know. Maybe I'm a little too close to the subject, but it does inspire hope. You know, these are dark times for Gotham and everyone in it. Well, I mean, darker than usual, I guess, because Gotham ain't a picnic to live in the best of times. And it's kind of universal in that, like, we all face dark times, too, every now and again. I don't know, this whole bit just worked for me. It landed. Maybe I'm in a weird place, or maybe it was just good writing. Maybe it was both. Overall, I gotta say this was a really good introduction to the Aftershock era. I mean, here we are starting to literally pick up the pieces. At this point, nobody in Gotham City knows what's in store for the next couple of years. And hell, I mean, I'm not a betting man, but I'm guessing a lot of folks in creative weren't 100% up to speed on what was to come too. All they can do now is try and address and, I guess, clean up the mess that was left in Cataclysm. Good stuff. Definitely worth checking out. I'm sure it won't break the bank to find this one. It's worth a peek, for sure. Now, before we get out of here, let's hop into the NML bag here. We got a few letters we're going to get to. We're going to start with Chris Yu talking about Detective 720. This was, episode 5 or 6, I think. He says, "The whole Batman in the Underground River is my strongest memory of the beginning of the storyline. That's what I remembered going in, and it holds true." And of course, this is that wonderful scene. This was Chuck Dixon just killing it. We have Batman going through the underground stream, trying to get to the surface. And he's being driven purely by the need to make sure Alfred is safe. You know, regardless of the cost to him, to Bruce Wayne or Batman, really. You know, the secret can come out, the cave can crumble, it doesn't matter, as long as he can get to the surface and find a way to rescue his friend. It's really, really good stuff. Chris continues, "The Huntress scene with 25 years of hindsight really sets up her journey over the next few years, but no spoilers from me." And the Huntress will be getting up to some stuff coming up early in No Man's Land proper and throughout. But, we're in for some Huntress candy here. It's going to be good stuff. Chris continues, "I would have loved to have seen the editorial flowcharts for what happened when and in which book. I'm interested to see if certain supporting characters stick to specific titles and creative teams, or if this was one comprehensive plot and whatever chapter fell in whichever title was just happenstance." And that's a cool idea. That is a really cool idea that, I'm not sure I'm equipped to do such a thing, but I'll try. I mean, I think it could be an interesting side study for this project here, just seeing which creators have kind of claimed which characters and which books are home to certain characters. I think that could be an interesting thing to do. I really get lost in the weeds with this kind of thing. Any kind of story that has, like, clear elements of research and preparation involved are the ones that I just, like, get lost in. You know, the one that always jumps out to me is Roy Thomas on All-Star Squadron. Like, anytime I read an issue of All-Star Squadron, I can just picture what Roy Thomas's writing room looks like. Because he tied in so much real world stuff with so much real Golden Age stuff and the sort of tweaked Golden Age stuff that was added in the, you know, early mid 80s or in the Bronze Age even. Just so much interesting stuff. I would love to see his whiteboard or his, I guess it was the early 80s. So the chalkboard that he was using to keep track of everything and specific dates in history and just all the fiction, nonfiction, movie references, just all that stuff. I would love to get a look at that kind of stuff if such a thing exists. And I remember reading like the DC Comics Guide to Writing Comics, which I think that might have been completely written by Paul Levitz. If not by Paul Levitz, he was definitely a big part of it, because that's where I first heard of the concept of the Levitz paradigm, which is basically a chalkboard with like everything that goes on in a family of books to keep everything straight. And it was I want to say there were pictures of the Levitz paradigm with Legion books, clearly Levitz and the Legion, but they were just so involved and so precise and specific and awesome stuff. And I would love to see a No Man's Land Levitz paradigm, or, you know, really any Levitz paradigm, but since we're working on No Man's Land, I'd love to see what was cooking behind the scenes there, and see what hit, what maybe didn't hit, what was retrialed, and just all that fun stuff. I get lost in the weeds. Back to Chris, he says, original letters pages are essential to any reprints. Reading the comments of the first 10 episodes of this project convinced me to tune in and listen. I needed to be in on those conversations. And I love that. I absolutely love that. The listener mail, the letters page that we have here on the show is a blast. It almost makes me feel like I have a social life. It's sad, isn't it? No, I just love the communication, the dialogue, just the exchange of ideas. You guys pointing out stuff that I missed. It's a blast. And to Chris's point here, the original letters pages are phenomenal. Just like I went through with the Alan Grant duality earlier. It really, I use and probably often misuse the word gestalt, but I love feeling like when I'm reading something, I'm actually in it. You know, like we're in those times. And I actually had a bit of a reminder over the weekend, and my buddy Walt, who we're going to read a letter from in a bit here, sent me a text saying that he got like a jump scare from the back cover of these books, because there's this, if you know, you know, there's a Gap ad, a full page Gap ad with like a creepy kid like winking at us. And I was reading one of these books over the weekend at the Kitchen Island, and the wife walked in and she's like, "What the hell are you reading?" And I'm like, "Batman." And she's like, no, what's on the back of that book?" And it's like this creepy kid winking at you. Even that creepy kid is part of the gestalt of these books here. To me, it's like I'll never be able to separate them. And I love that I can actually kind of place myself where I was the first time I saw these books, or the first time I saw that ad, or whatever it is. So, yeah, these original letters pages, we're definitely going to be including them. They're going to become a fixture, of course, as we get to relevant letters. And I mean, I will point things out if there's interesting things before we get there, because, you know, anything's fun to talk about. Let's keep it with Chris here. He's talking about Shadow the Bat 74. He says that he's laughing because every time he hears Quake Master, he thinks of the Shock Master too. And I think for people of our generation or cohort who might have been tangentially aware of professional wrestling characters, we probably all think that, because that's the first thing that jumped out to me, and a couple of people I've talked to, same thing. Chris continues, the reading order is starting to veer into the territory of the unimportant books not fitting in with the important ones. Now, this is Shadow of the Bat 74. He says, the last time we saw Batman before the Blackgate one-shot, he had surfaced from the Underground River and seen Gotham destroyed for the first time. At the start of this issue, Batman pulls himself from the river, yet the reading order had this had his adventures in Blackgate happening in between his surfacing and getting out of the water. Just goes to show how reading order lists don't always follow the logical order of the story. I'm sure the lists were just composed from the dates the issues were originally on sale and not with a through line of the story in mind. And I blame editorial, and I blame them as well. We've kind of talked about this, like, especially when we talked about, like, that issue of Robin. You know, Robin 52, where, like, it was part 4 or part 5 of a previous story with only, like, 3 pages of Cataclysm, but it's still a chapter of Cataclysm. Yeah, I'm guessing that a lot of this was just compiled, and then they worried about making it fit after the fact, which, for all I know, because I haven't gone back to, like, Mike's Amazing World to see exact release dates for these episodes, for these issues. Like, the Blackgate issue and the that other issue might have come out the same day, and they were meant to be read the other way, and they were just marked the one way. I mean, who knows? Definitely, the finger could be pointed to editorial. And again, I feel like I keep looking at this through the current year lens, where, like, things are contradicted within the same book, continuity-wise nowadays, where this feels a lot more structurally sound, at least in hindsight, with everything that's happened since. But definitely interesting, you know, food for thought and conversation. I definitely want to thank Chris for taking the time to listen and write in. Now let's wrap things up with a letter from our friend Walt. Now he says, I just caught up on Thursday and Friday's episodes. I really enjoyed yours and CJ's thoughts / topic / interaction. I did too. That was a lot of fun. Walt says he probably enjoyed that more than the actual issue covered during that episode. And I don't remember which issue it was, but I wager I feel the same way, because that was some fun conversations there. Walt continues, I also realized that in driving and listening, just sort of had a contentment and peace that I don't often feel and I haven't felt in a while. I really appreciate your shows and not having commercials and such. Just you and comics talk and people's thoughts. Something authentic and pure and just straight up enjoyable. 3 weeks and I'm glad you're back to podcasting. DC, Marvel, comics, X-specific, Bat-specific, I get to listen to a friend talk about comics and comics-related stuff in a way that feels all too rare. And that means a lot. That means a heck of a lot. And I didn't share your entire email with the wife, but I did share this part with my wife. And I've said this before, I hate sounding like a broken record, but it took a lot for me to come back to talking to myself into a microphone. It took a lot. And I never expected anybody to care. I'm just very much that way. So comments like this really do hit home for me in a way that it's hard for me to put into words. So definitely thank you for that. Walt continues. He says, I can't remember if I'd already written about the pricing at various shops and the variance in pricing at shops. I've definitely noticed that some shops will have ridiculously high to-the-day pricing, while others seem to have bargain pricing. Now, to-the-day pricing sucks. As a seasoned bin diver, it always... Man, and I understand comics retail is a business, so this is definitely a value-added move for the comic shops, but as a bargain hunter and just a plain old comics hunter, the two-of-the-day pricing, it can sting. Especially when they, like, don't take the original price tag off, they just put another one on top of it. Like, if a character suddenly gets hot, or if a character's in a movie, the price on their back issues goes up. Yeah, sometimes some shops don't even bother, which is great. Some shops do bother, and that kind of stinks. Of course, to-the-day pricing can go to your benefit, or it can go to your detriment, because, you know, if a book, I mean, we'll use the gold standard for the early 90s, Youngblood #1. You know, the day that book was released, it was $5 in the bins. Or it was $5 on the wall, actually. I've told that story many, many, many times. Too many times, probably. But as time rolled on, it would get repriced in the bins. It would go down to $3. It would go down to cover price. It would go down to $1. It would go down to 50 cents. It would go down to a dime. Because they just wanted to move the damn thing. Nobody wanted it. So to the day pricing, double-edged sword. Walt continues. He says, a couple shops I frequent seem to price a book based on what's profitable to them and when they put the issue into the back issue bins. So if an issue sits there for 3 to 5 years, it may wind up seeming like a bargain compared to a shop that priced the issue much more recently. So basically what we were just talking about, the to the day thing. So, you know, if a book comes out, they throw a $5 price tag on it, the character in the book gets hot and they just don't go through the bins to reprice it, you're getting a bargain, you're getting a deal, which is pretty cool. Walt continues. At one new-to-me shop a couple weeks ago, I spotted a sign at the register that essentially said, if you want to negotiate on price, you acknowledge that the price may not be up to date and thus be subject to repricing at current market values. I've seen that before, and you know, the entire idea of negotiating a price, that is so alien to me. I just can't do it. A few weeks ago, I was in a shop looking for a couple of missing issues of No Man's Land, and I saw a guy come in looking to trade Funko Pops for. It was a Ditko issue of Spider-Man, so an old issue of Spider-Man, and he wanted to trade like 3 Funko Pops and pay like $100 for this book. And I was like secondhand embarrassed for the guy. It's like, what are you doing? Just buy the damn book. There's a price tag on the book. Either you buy it or you don't. And I mean, I've never been a haggler. I like getting things cheap, but I'm never gonna try to work it. Yeah, I just don't feel right doing that. I feel wrong doing most things. So negotiating on price is definitely alien to me. The idea that you could negotiate on price and come out winning or come out losing is interesting. And there was a shop here in Phoenix. I mean, they're still around just with a different name. They were gone for a good decade, but people who used to read Wizard will remember Atomic Comics. Anywhere you lived, the Atomic Comics ads were like in every issue of Wizard. So when I moved out here from New York, like I already knew a comic store because I saw it so many times in Wizard. And they were a good shop, but there was a time where they weren't exactly repricing the bins, but they were repricing the bins. I went in, and this is right when I started collecting DC, or backfilling DC. I wanted to get the Gerard Jones Green Lantern, which of course has a different connotation now, but I wanted to fill in that run. And I had picked up, I think it was like issues 11 through 20. And they were in the bins for $2 each, which I'm like, cool, yeah, I could do that, why not? So you get the 10 books, $20, you get a nice run. Well, I get up to the counter and the guy's like, oh yeah, we're repricing the back issues. And I'm like, okay, he's like, look at the sign. And I'm like, what sign? And he's like, we must have the sign up at a different location, because they had like 5 locations at this point. And he went on to look online to find the new prices for these issues of Green Lantern. So the $20 I was looking to spend suddenly turned into like $75. And I'm like, no, keep them. I'm not doing that. There's no way I'm doing that. I wasn't there to negotiate. And I wasn't there to pay what wasn't on the sticker. And I thought it was kind of a dick move to do that when there was no sign up. Like if there was a sign up at the bin saying, hey, we're repricing, so these prices aren't current. Well, then, you know, I'm taking responsibility. But to not have that opt-out clause in my shopping, it got under my skin. Really got under my skin, and I was not a fan of that. I've gone to a few shops that will do that. One shop opened probably, 15 years ago, probably 14 years ago, around 2010, I think. And I went in as they were like opening and put in, like literally putting up the shelves. And they had bins, so I was in there, and nothing had prices on it. So when I went up to the counter, I'm like, I found like three books I wanted. And I'm like, hey, are these cover price? And he's like, no, of course not. And he was not shy about popping onto eBay. And he quoted me these prices that were ridiculous. And I passed. You know, it's, that's, you know, I believe very, very strongly in supporting comics retail. But that kind of stuff, not a fan. Not a fan. Walt continues about the repricing negotiation. He says, if you're confident it really, honestly should be cheaper and can back it up with like a recent sold listing on eBay, then great. If you're just trying to further discount something for other purposes, well, maybe suck it up and take the price you see. And again, that's my motto in the bins here. You know, if something has a $5 price tag on it and there's no sale going on in the store, I need to be okay with paying $5 for it. You know, otherwise it stays in the bin, you know? And I've talked about like there'll be three copies of the same book in the bin and like one will be $10, one will be $5, one will be $4. And they're all in the same condition. It's just a matter of not repricing, right? Walt continues, I've also definitely noticed in the last few years that books that I used to routinely see in the quarter bins are now being priced and put in the regular back issue bins. And if you are frequenter of comics retail, I'm sure you've seen that. I mean, I've seen books go from the quarter bins to the wall, you know, where they're bag tagged and on the wall with at least a double digit price tag. I remember coming into, like, one of the things that I used to see in the bins all the time was the Marvel ROM run. Just total quarter bin fodder. And I bought a great deal of them in the quarter bins. I never had interest in it, but you know, when I see a full run, I can't resist. I'm a very, very weak individual. But I'm starting to see those on the wall now. Like ROM number one, I got that out of a quarter bin. And I saw it on the wall a few weeks ago for $30. It's like, oy, that's pretty crazy, you know? Walt continues. I recently picked up the No Man's Land issues of Catwoman for about $4 a piece at a shop, and yet the only copies I could find online were being offered for $40 plus. And yeah, that's one we talked about early on. One that almost scared me out of pursuing the project. Because before I hit the road and pounded the pavement looking for the books that I was missing, I figured, hey, I'll check to see what the going rate is. And I popped on to, you know, all the normal haunts, you know, Midtown and Mile High and My Comic Shop. And yeah, those issues of Catwoman were in the $40 range. And I'm like, holy cow. And there were like seven of them. So it's like, I'm going to be paying just for Catwoman like $300. And then, you know, I went to the shop and I found them for $3 each. So it's okay. But it's definitely... there's definitely a lot of variation in price. And I don't know, I think a lot of that has to do with the CGC and just the grades. Even when they're not slabbed, it's like, you know, a 5.0 to you might be a 7.0 to me. You know, I feel like when you get into the nitty gritty like that, it can really, really muddy things up. And I mean, I don't know. I'm a big fan of just having reader copies of everything anyway. I'm never looking to make money off this. This isn't an investment for me. This is building a library, you know, that I'll never read all of course. But I don't know. It's the variation in prices is pretty staggering. Walt continues. He says, hopefully I'll catch up with the show soon and I'll have more to say then. In the meantime, in my own binge reading, I'm up to chapter 12 of Cataclysm and quite enjoying that, despite just having listened to the summary/discussion of the issues. I'm actually picking stuff up that I might have glossed over reading on my own in a vacuum. Well, thank you so much for writing in, Walt, and thank you for those wonderful topics I could leap off of here. I I love here, you know, this is the coolest thing about this is it's not only this little book club we have, but it's, you know, comics history is also our history. I will always say that. And we have so much in common as collectors and as readers and as people who get lost in these fantastical worlds and would almost prefer them to the real world. We have these common experiences, or these experiences in common, I think is the right way to say that. And we can still, you know, share unique stories with one another. And it's at the risk of over romanticizing things, it's magical to me. I really, really get a lot out of it. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your experiences in the bins. It really does make the show what it is. And what it is to me is very, very special. So thank you. But I think that's where we will close it off today. I think we're approaching on an hour, which is way too long to hear me talk. So if anybody out there would like to chime in, please, please feel free to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, 90s X-Men Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter. But with all that having been said, I want to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks, starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall.